Well, I'm ready.
Well, let's do it then.
All right. Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to music and movies and television, theatre sometimes, not a lot, but sometimes. In fact, anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
And this week, what's been entertaining us is well, first of all, musicians young and, well, let's be delicate here, not quite so young. I've had the great good fortune of having a chat with Melissa Etheridge, who's shortly to tour here with Sheryl Crow.
That sounds like a good chat. I'm looking forward to that. Steve and I have seen a much younger performer, an up-and-comer. He's 23 years old. He calls himself Lauf, and he's just performed his one and only New Zealand show.
Now, we had high hopes in the cinema department for Oscar winner Alicia Vikander as she rebooted the role of Lara Croft in the Tomb Raider series. But, I don't know. I think our hopes were raided somewhat, weren't they?
They were raided. Mind you, another Oscar winner, Natalie Portman, I think has had some success leading a cast in a thoughtful sci-fi thriller called Annihilation. Annihilation? Annihilation. Annihilation. How do you say that?
I'm going with Annihilation.
And I'll go with what you're going with.
I mean, did the word not come up at any point in the
script? It did.
Well, I'd be going with how they said it, Simon.
Annihilation is what it's called.
There we go. And I gather you're going to have a word, aren't you, on the remake of the Charles Bronson Vigilante classic from 74, Death Wish.
I'll even go to two words. They are, don't go.
Oh, dear. Oh, well, that's the review done and dusted. Then we can move on, can't we?
I know, we can move on.
Right, well, tell you what. Let's do something more pleasant and more palatable to begin with. Yes. Let's start with something that's a bit more fresh in our minds. Now, Simon, you and I were at the power station in Auckland last night, weren't we? Yep. To see, was it a bit of an old mate of yours these days? young American pop star with a Latvian name, as he puts it in your interview. He's from a country called Latvia.
Yes, yes. His Lauf is how he's is the stage name he's got, and he is from Latvia. We did interview him just last month on Crave. If you go to our website, cravepodcast.com, search for February the 20th, and you can have a little hear the chat that I had with him then. He's getting pretty well known, certainly amongst the younger set, for some songs like I Like Me Better, Paris in the Rain is another one of his hits, and Getting Over You. They're pop songs. They're about love. Of course, they are. That's what he wants to sing about, and that's what he sang about last night at the power station.
He did indeed, and he went down a storm. It was a pretty minimal show, wasn't it? There was him at the front of the stage. There was a drummer and a keyboard player hidden toward the back. So it was a pretty pared-down show. And, I mean, he did what he did very, very well.
Yes, he's a young pop star. He's quite an accomplished musician. Doing research for the interview, Steve, he's studied music. He plays a number of instruments. He's written songs for other artists for a long time. He's only 23. But I thought he was an accomplished pop singer. He had a good stagecraft. He certainly got the young people really into his songs. A lot of the songs, the very young audience there seemed to know the lyrics too. He played one new song. He was good. I don't know what else to say about the guy. I mean, I think he seemed like a genuinely good guy. You can imagine going and having a beer with them afterwards.
Well, or a kebab.
Or a kebab, as he said, yes.
Yeah, I did find, though, to be honest, and maybe this is a function of both my age and yours, because either of us probably double the age of any pair of audience members you could find.
And then some,
yeah. I found his music, it's sort of an electronic dance music toned down to be a little bit more poppy with a slightly high-pitched vocal over it. And I found him, in the end, I don't know about you, very energetic, very enthusiastic. I mean, he gives a good show, but he's a little one-note, isn't he?
I see what you're saying. I think some of the – a couple of his more successful pop songs, I thought they were quite catchy. Maybe this is a sign of our generation. The stuff that I enjoyed the most and I'll remember most is when he actually picked up a guitar.
Yes.
And played some guitar. And I mean, I thought he was a reasonably decent guitarist and played a couple of nice little lead breaks. And that's what sort of gelled with me. I'm not going to race out to see him again. But look, we felt very old, didn't we, in that audience? And looking around us, I thought, well, most of these people here, boy, are they going to see him again if they get the chance.
Well, there was one moment in particular. I mean, you could tell he was working the crowd really well, and they were ready to be worked. And he wanted everyone to bob down onto the floor so they could all spring up when he hit a certain chord.
And then you remind me.
Two blokes in their 50s in the middle of a youthful audience. And I think he probably heard our knees creak on the way down, didn't he? So possibly we're not the right fellows to be reviewing this show, is what I'm trying to say here.
Anyway, if I stand still in one spot for an hour and a half, I'm telling you, I'm not in my best shape, you know what I'm saying?
But I think the point is, though, really, that we are maybe not the ideal reviewers because, yeah, I mean, we could stand there, oh, yes, he's a jolly, decent performer, and he's got a good voice, and he's got a great beat. But I don't think, really, that our opinions in that audience last night were at all either reflective or relevant.
No. The key thing is, and it's everyone there had a hell of a good time. So that's the main thing. We should just quickly mention, Steve, the opening act, which was a local act called LA Women. No hint of a Doors song in sight.
No, I was hoping for a Doors tribute act.
Yeah. What an amazing thing happened right at the very end.
They actually played their instruments.
Yes. What we mean here is that they rely on computer-programmed, pre-recorded, I think, sort of keyboard tracks and other instrumental tracks. And twice the laptop failed. And then the electric guitar failed at one point as well. And for the last song, they said, bugger the computer, we're just going to play our instruments.
Shock. Horror.
What a radical thought.
Yes.
And how I quite enjoyed that song.
Did they pull it off, Simon?
Well, I think they did. It just sounded a bit more genuine somehow, to me anyway.
It was probably the high point of their set, to be fair, wasn't it?
I think it was.
I mean, I don't think we're being entirely fair to LA Women here. It was three youngish lads from Auckland. Yes. I mean, to be absolutely blunt, they are still learning their craft. I think we have to be fair about that. But they are definitely learning their craft. And I think they said, you know, the drummer's like 19 years old, I think they said at one point.
Yeah.
And this was probably the biggest show they've ever played.
Yeah. And their music wasn't that far removed with what Love was doing, you know, in the next set. I mean, it was that similar sort of pop genre, wasn't it? Sort of heartfelt lyrics,
yeah,
a lot of keyboards and drums and bass, and you know, it's of that genre.
And I felt awfully bad for them when their kit failed. I did feel rotten for them. Yeah, I have a feeling we might be hearing more of them in the future.
I think we will. Okay, so that was Love at the Power Station in Auckland last night. On a Monday night.
Absolutely. Yes, he did make that point a couple of times, didn't he? Yes. So I mean, what do we say? We reckon basically, you know, we could be here at the start of two acts who could actually turn out to be something a little bit special. One of them's already getting there.
Yes. And look, mate, in 10 years' time, we'll be there with our Zimmer frames to record the action.
Absolutely. No, it was worth going.
Yeah.
Let's take a break. Let's go to the pictures for a moment, because there's a new big, I mean, huge budget action blockbuster that, I don't know about you, I was ready for a good night out to go and see Tomb Raider.
I was too. This is the rebooted Tomb Raider, of course, and this is the one with an Oscar-winning actress in the role, Alicia Vikander, playing Lara Croft. And she had some accomplished character actors alongside her, Walton Goggins, Dominic West. And looking at the trailer, which I saw a couple of times, I thought, well, this looks pretty decent. It looks like it's got some quality to it, look, a few thrills. So my hopes, like yours, Steve, were pretty high.
And it's one of those films where really you should watch the trailer and just be left with high hopes.
You should. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because let's face it, didn't really live up to them, did it?
No, I think this was a cross, not a tick, but a cross. And I don't like to have to say that, because I think Alicia Vikander is a good actress, and I think she basically did a good job. But the movie, for me, was flat. The story did not engage me that much. I felt I'd seen it a lot of times before, and it at times so strongly evoked Raiders of the Lost Ark as to be almost laughable. And it took itself a bit too seriously to be a good old-fashioned action stomp a la Indiana Jones, but not seriously enough that you would call it something like, I don't know, a Jason Bourne or anything like that. And she played it generally most of the time very seriously, I thought. So I didn't think they got the tone quite right. The story wasn't that engaging. And yes, lots of stunts, but you see lots of stunts in lots of movies these days. You can't just rely on the stunts. The characters have got to be there. The script's got to be there. The story's got to be there.
Well, you mentioned the story, and it's fairly flimsy little story, isn't it? You've got Lara Croft, who's clearly on her uppers in London, and she's been persuaded by her dad's old business partner that she should sign papers saying that they're going to give him up as dead because he's been missing for 7 years. She finally caves in, and she's given his effects, and it's got some papers about a Japanese queen called Himiko from the 7th century, whose body is been buried. She's been buried alive on an island in the South China Sea, or the Yellow Sea, or somewhere like that. It's not quite clear. And an evil organization, got to have a good evil organization, called Trinity this time, wants to dig her up and weaponize her. And so she has to get to Hong Kong, get on a boat to Yamatai, this little island. Yep. And that's where she runs into Walton Goggins, who works for Trinity and is trying to do a bit of archaeology by dynamite.
And he doesn't mind if he knocks off a few of his labourers along the way.
Well, he's somehow miraculous. He's got this slave troop of labourers that we've got no idea where they came from. Yeah. And that's a large part of the entire film. You don't know why anything's happening. You don't know where these people are from, what their motivations are, what they're all about. You don't know what's driving any of them. Yeah. And so as a result, once they get Lara out of London, where she's actually quite brilliant, that first 20 minutes of the film, do you remember the bicycle chase?
I do, yeah.
Did you hold your breath? Were you impressed?
I'm going to take slight issue with you here. I was reasonably impressed. I think you really enjoyed that opening
sort
of stanza.
Yeah.
I didn't get so gripped by it, to be honest with you, Steve. I thought it was a little too slow for me. But anyway, that's...
I was impressed with it, which is possibly why my disappointment in the rest of the film was all the more crushing.
Right.
That's possibly why it killed me. But it wasn't just that. I mean, obviously the history is absolute twaddle. You've got two phenomenal actors that you just called out there, Dominic West and Walton Goggins.
Yeah.
Both of whom really, really need to have a good long word with themselves and each other, quite possibly.
Well, can I just ask you something about this? Because I've been thinking about this a bit lately when we've been chatting about movies and we think, oh, so-and-so didn't do a good job. How much of it is the actor not delivering? And how much blame do we sheet with the writer? The script writer and the director who's giving the actor some directions about what they want, what to say and how to say it. We criticize the actor because that's the person we see on screen delivering us the action. But I wonder sometimes. I think the whole pitch of this film wasn't quite right, and I wonder if the writing is
well. That's, that's
where the
got
trouble
to,
started.
That's got to be part of it, because Goggins and West, they're actors, not turd polishers. So if you give them a load of rubbish to work with, they can only do so much. And then also the director. That has to be where the book stops. He's the one who's driving the film. It's his film. He's the auteur of the film. His job there is to get the best out of his actors. And if that's the best you can get out of Walton Goggins, then seriously, maybe you should become a bicycle courier yourself.
No, that was a very toned down Walton Goggins. I've seen him do so much better roles. So I think I think he was acting under instruction, and the instruction was misplaced. That's my take on it.
Grossly. I think the other thing that we could mention is, I don't know about you, I caught myself playing a game of Spot the Influence.
Oh.
And, I mean, it's obvious this film wanted to be two Raiders of the Lost Ark. It's quite obvious that's where it was going at the end.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you've got some scenes there that, you know, in tunnels and evading traps that are almost a straight lift from Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Shameless right down to the... and blatant lift.
Oh, totally. I mean, either it's paying a wonderful homage or it's a very terribly unimaginative screenplay.
It depends how generous we're being, and I'm not inclined to be from the rest of the film. The whole hidden secret island thing was done better in Viet Cong Skull Island last year.
That's
damning with fake praise if ever there was.
Yeah.
There was, what else did we see in there I'm trying to remember now. Maybe I'm being unfair. Maybe this is me being too picky. But anytime you've got a young woman in a fix with a bow and arrow,
yes,
straight away drawn to you think Hunger Games. There are certain things that are now reserved iconography, and that's got to be one of them, unfortunately. It's not fair, but you don't get to have a young woman protagonist with a bow and arrow unless it's going to be what's her name? I didn't say Jennifer Saunders for a second then. And that is, to be fair, a film I'd like to see.
Yes, yes, yes. I think we both agree on one thing. Didn't even get close to it being a successful film. I think the whole thing was a bit flat, and I think you liked the first part. What about Alicia Vikander? There's a couple of moments where she's asked to be a little bit more lighthearted, but I just found, because most of the time she's been really a grim and gritty action hero, I didn't buy the humor when it came along. I thought, well, where does that come from? It didn't seem to fit what we'd seen in the lead up to it. And so for that reason, I wasn't so satisfied with her either, although I think she's a good actress.
I think she's a cracking actor. And you know, we've seen her other stuff where she's definitely better. I mean, the Academy have seen fit to bestow honors on her.
Yes,
we know she's capable of better. But yeah, I mean, she was probably so disgusted by all the huge plot holes that stomped their way through this film that she probably couldn't crack a smile any longer. The tone of the film, it didn't know what it really wanted to be. And as you said to me on the way out of the screening, Raiders of the Lost Ark had a genuine sense of fun. Like you just said right now, it's a stomping romp through an action film.
Yeah, yeah.
But there was sense of joy and fun and adventure in this.
No, there wasn't. No, there wasn't. It took itself too seriously. That's probably the best way to put it.
But I think all of that I could possibly have forgiven. Possibly. I'm not saying definitely. If it weren't for the final scene.
Oh, okay. Explain.
Now, obviously, we're not going to give spoilers away here, but the final scene, there is a twist. In the very last scene, which doesn't do anything, obviously, because it's the final scene, the film itself now cannot build on that twist. You suddenly realise, I've sat there for the last 2 hours watching an intro.
Yeah, this is we can say that it's an origin film. It gives you the backstory of how Lara Croft becomes the Tomb Raider, right? We can say that.
Very definitely, yes.
Yeah. All right, yep, that's true. So, I'm not inclined to recommend this particularly heartily at all. I can imagine that some people wanting to see Alicia Vikander tackle a role like this, and I can imagine, like me, people seeing the trailer and thinking, oh, that looks a good action romp. It's middling at best, sadly, middling at best for me.
At best. Well, tell you what, since we've had a good kick around of a slightly fantasy-ish film with a potentially very strong female lead.
Yes.
Why don't we move to another fantasy film with a number of strong female leads?
Yes. I'm talking about, it's just come out in the last week or so, it's a science fiction movie called Annihilation. Now, a bit of an odd backstory to this one, Steve. It's been released cinematically in the United States and China, but apparently one of the financiers from Paramount Pictures reportedly thought this film was a bit too intellectual and a bit too complicated, and it wasn't worth spending the money to get it released at the cinema right around the world. So for the rest of us, including us here in New Zealand, we get to see it on Netflix, which is what I did a few days ago. I don't know whether that's a good argument. I sometimes wonder that this is a film with a very strong female cast. There's action elements to it, and it's women in those action roles, and maybe that film producer thought that wasn't going to sell tickets. I don't know. I wonder about that. But look, this is a sci-fi. It's mostly a sort of a serious, thoughtful sci-fi. A little bit like that film from last year called Arrival with Amy Adams and Jeremy Renner, which was a slow build. I didn't like the ending of that film, but it was a serious film. It wasn't a Star Wars.
And no, not at all.
Generally, this is an interesting one because it's generally serious. It's about some sort of alien entity which strikes the Earth. It hits a lighthouse, and it forms some sort of a bubble around the lighthouse that's called a shimmer. And anything that goes into the shimmer doesn't come out.
Oh, dear.
And so it's about the scientists trying to figure out what the heck's going on there and how to get to the bottom of the mystery. Natalie Portman plays one of those scientists, and she leads a team. There are five women altogether, scientists of different ilks, and they try to get to the bottom of it. And without giving too much of the plot away, what the shimmer does is meddle with genetic makeup.
Oh, okay.
And with some fascinating results, both in terms of physical appearances and also it appears in terms of and this is you know, what you think, what you feel, what you remember. So okay. it is interesting. It is a layered storytelling technique. There are different timelines going on. The ending is open to interpretation, and I've seen online lots of theories about what the ending means. There are some good, apart from Natalie Portman, we've got Tessa Thompson, who's just been in the Thor movie, Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's a very accomplished actress. Oscar Isaac plays the main male role, of recent Star Wars fame, but this time in a more serious movie. Some good effects, an interesting mix of sort of thoughtful drama and genuine thriller scenes. And maybe that might mean it won't be everyone's cup of tea. Steve, I could imagine some people wanting more thrills and some people wanting less thrills in a movie like this. And it may end up not, you know, trying to have a foot in two camps and not necessarily satisfying either. But overall, I enjoyed it. I don't mind a good sci-fi. I thought this was pretty good, and I would recommend it. I think Natalie Portman is good, and she does a really good fist at being an action hero, actually, in this film. Not that one should be surprised by that, but she does it very well.
But it's just extending her range even further, isn't it?
Yeah.
I have to ask because, you know, I mean, we've heard stories, apocryphal, I realise, but the story goes that years ago, studios changed the name of the release of The Madness of George III. In American cinemas, because they were concerned that Americans would think it was a sequel, and it was changed to The Madness of King George. Now, I don't know for certain that story is true. I choose to believe it because I like it, and if it is true, it speaks volumes for the perception that people will have for this film. So was it too intellectual?
Oh, no, it wasn't too intellectual, but I think it's got a strong mystery element to it.
Right.
So you're not quite sure what this shimmer thing does, and it doesn't neatly tie up the story at the end either. So it could be unsatisfying to some people if you just like to have A plus B equals C in your story at a movie. So, I mean, for goodness sake, does anyone remember a film called 2001: A Space Odyssey?
Quite a hit, wasn't it?
I think it was one of the most influential films of all time, and that wasn't. I remember seeing that when I was a young lad, and not knowing what the hell was going on at the end of that film.
That was a non-trivial undertaking, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yes. So those sort of films can work, and they can provide entertainment or interest. And I think this overall, I would recommend it, and I think it was good. Yep.
There is one other thing I'm going to take you to task for. You've not mentioned probably the key female lead in Annihilation.
Okay, go on. You see, looking at his notes.
Yeah, Gina Rodriguez.
Okay, all right. Well, okay, yes. She's one of the band of five who go into the Shimmer. Yeah,
she plays Anya, doesn't she?
Yes.
And if you've not been watching her in Jane the Virgin...
Oh, well, I haven't.
Then what are you doing with your life?
What am I doing with my life?
Okay, I'll grant you, lately it's been slightly disappointing, but the first two or three series of Jane the Virgin are as entertaining a slice of mindless television as you will ever see.
Okay, all right. Well, you've convinced me to have a look at that. Thank you.
And I think you've probably sold me on Annihilation, I think, to be honest.
I think it's worth a look. I do. And it's, you know, you can, if you've got Netflix, you can look at it at your leisure.
I fully intend to.
Okay. So, Steve, we're going to keep the female theme going here, but we'll shift back to rock music because you mentioned at the top of our podcast a chat you had, you lucky bugger, with Melissa Etheridge.
Oh, you've talked to her before.
That was a long time ago.
Okay, fair enough. Fair enough. Yes. Yeah, she's touring here in April with Sheryl Crow. It's an interesting double act, but that seems to be a bit of a theme these days, doesn't it?
Yes.
But she's doing an interesting combination of cities as well. Auckland, Hamilton and Wellington.
Not getting to the South Island at all.
No, getting close to it. I think you can see the South Island, can't you?
Yeah, you can.
It's not all quite right, the same, true. I realise.
Yes.
Obviously, the dates for her tour, or their tour, I should say, are on our website, cravepodcast.com. But I caught the opportunity to have a wee chat with her ahead of their tour next month. And I had a chat with her about the upcoming Melissa Etheridge cruise, her next album, and why she's touring with Sheryl Crow this time round. She's really quite a cool lady. Good morning, Melissa. Thank you very much for talking to Crave this morning. Steve here.
Hey, Steve.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm hanging out in Florida.
Oh, whereabouts in Florida? That's my old home.
I really live in Fort Lauderdale right now.
Oh, okay. What are you doing in Fort Lauderdale?
Last night we were in Fort Myers. We've had a gig there, and we had just got to Fort Lauderdale a few minutes ago. And tomorrow we start the Melissa Etheridge cruise.
Oh, you have to tell me about that. The Melissa Etheridge cruise, it sounds wonderful.
It's all about music, great music artists. Sarah McLachlan's playing with me this year, and there's just a whole bunch of really strong musical artists, really diverse, and a whole bunch of people that love music and are kind, and it's just a very diverse boat filled with a lot of people, who are loving life.
Well, that sounds fantastic, and I'm guessing your itinerary is going to be the Caribbean. I don't suppose you're coming down to New Zealand anytime soon with that, are you?
Oh, no, not for the cruise.
Oh, that's
cruise
a shame.
Is going on to, we're going to Puerto Rico. There'll be a service there.
Sounds fantastic. Now, I know you are coming down to New Zealand next month. It's the first time you've been here in a couple of years, isn't it?
Yeah, I was there 2 years ago. I had such a great time, and so excited to bring my band back this time and co-headline with Sheryl Crow.
Now, you say co-headline. I was going to ask which one of you guys is going to be the support act, but clearly I think you've already answered that question for me.
that's what it is. We'll each be doing 90 minutes and, just bringing it down.
Sounds fantastic. How did the tour come about? Because I know we've had quite a few female double acts playing recently. We had Stevie Nicks and the Pretenders here last year, and we had Blondie and Cyndi Lauper. So how did you and Sheryl come to be playing together?
Well, I think that it's something we have talked about, my God, since the mid-90s. For 20 years, we've been talking about, hey, we need to do this sort of, we need to go out together, and then life and albums and things happen and crisscross. And finally, last year, it was like, okay, next summer, our agencies and everybody went, this is perfect. And the folks in Australia were all like, and New Zealand were all like, yeah, well, let's do it.
So the stars have aligned. So I notice you don't have any new material to promote this tour, do you?
No, I'm writing and I'm in the studio, and I'll be finishing up the album right after I come back. So, no, not yet.
Now, can you tell us anything about this album? Because I've been listening to your most recent release was your Memphis Rock and Soul album. And I was having a quick listen this morning, and it sounds like a departure from, I remember listening to your very first album back 30 years ago, and it's different.
Oh, yeah, because this is music that is not, I didn't write it. I wrote some of the, I rewrote some stuff, but I, this is, it's a tribute even to how I, the music that meant so much to me that I found over the years, that growing up in Kansas, we had one radio station and they played everything. So I grew up, I didn't grow up with these boundaries in my music. I could hear Tammy Wynette, then I could hear Marvin Gaye, then I could hear Led Zeppelin. It didn't matter. It was all music, and so that's my inspirations were all that, and so much of it was deeply rooted in Otis Redding and this soul music that was coming out of Stax that just was blowing my mind in the, you know, late 60s, early 70s. And so I wanted to really go back and say, look, this is, you hear the way I sang, you hear where I'm coming from? This is the base that I'm, you know, standing on. This is what it's about right here.
Right. So given that you don't have a new album to promote and you've got quite an extensive back catalogue to choose from, how are you putting your set list together?
Well, because I don't get down to New Zealand that often, I'm definitely just doing the hits.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the songs that I, over the years, I know that people enjoy, you know, the ones that really make for, you know, 90 minutes of pure pleasure.
Right.
So that's, you know, you'll be hearing all the hits.
So to be cheesy about it, it's basically the greatest hits set, I suppose. Now, I did have a cheeky look at a set list online, and I'm very disappointed not to see Brave and Crazy in there, because that is a wonderful song. But I see that.
I'll play that one. Yeah.
Oh, do please. I love that song. But I notice 30 years in, and you know, you're still playing "Bring Me Some Water," and there is so much heartbreak in that song. And I have to ask you, how do you still find the fire and the energy for that after all these years?
Oh my gosh! All I have to do is start that song, and the audience has all the fire and energy that I need. And that song. Anywhere in the world, if I start that, just the beginning of it, it's like that's one of those things that a musician dreams of. That
right.
People would have that reaction, you know. So it that one, I like the way I do. Just forget it. It's, you know, everyone has their own experience of that song, so
yes.
They add to it. I just basically hop on top of it and ride the waves.
what a treat that must be. Because yeah, I mean, I remember the very first time I heard that song, I was an Englishman at college in Pennsylvania and watching MTV for the first time, and I thought, wow, what is this? I was yeah, quite impressed. I even bought the album on vinyl.
Oh, yay.
So I was going to ask, because this is something that's a little bit personal for me, because I'm by trade a high school teacher, I've noticed that you're going back and working in a high school in Kansas, isn't it? Tell me about that.
In Kansas, I'm trying to figure out what you're talking about.
I beg your pardon. I misread my notes. It's in Indiana, Merrillville, Indiana. Or is Wikipedia lying to you?
Merrillville, Indiana. I went to a women's... In Indiana, Merrillville, Indiana.
Okay.
I'm not sure what
okay.
you mean. I went to a women's...
I think we need to update your Wikipedia page here, because it says in September you started working part-time at Andrean High School in Merrillville, Indiana. I'm going to have to go and edit this for you.
Please, that's where, you know, it's funny, I always thought maybe I should look at that page every now and then and see if the info's right. Wow.
Well, it clearly didn't make a lasting impression on you.
I went to a women's correctional.
Yeah, this clearly didn't make a lasting impression on you.
No, I'm trying to think. Oh, okay, yeah. No. I do a lot of things, but I don't know if I'm doing that. I'm not sure. It might be something that I just don't remember. But.
No, that's fair enough. Fair enough.
I don't think so.
So let's go back to your new album. You're working on it right now. Tell us more about the musical style. Where are you headed next?
Well, these songs that are on it are songs I've been writing for the last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still in the middle of recording them. But and they've been growing and growing, and they started. I sort of demoed them. I laid them all down. I laid the drums. And my bass player come in, because I'm not fond of playing bass.
Okay.
But I did everything else, guitars and keyboards, and sort of drew out the sketch. And now I've brought it to John Shanks, and we're sort of setting it up and making them just big, beautiful songs. And they're you know, some of them are personal love, some of them are fun, rocking, and some of them are very, you know, topical about what's happening now and kind of what's happening to ourselves, each of us. Not so much, you know, old preachy sing-along songs or anything, but songs about what it's like to be a human being alive in this time right now of tumultuous change, you know, and trying to be inspirational about it and really, really sing to the heart of the matter.
Right, because I know certainly your first few albums was intensely personal lyrics, and there was a lot of pain going into them. I was wondering, what's making you angry now?
Well, certainly have. I did go through my own personal, you know, experience of falling in love with myself, and I think that's what my first 20 years of my career was. And now it's like, I'm there. I can, the last 10 years has been about me waking up and knowing that, I love what I do. Now let me just do it. And it's about the world. It's about how I am in the world. It's about the relationships I have, from being a wife and lover to, a mother to a stranger to a, all those things. It's all those things that we are.
Fantastic. Now, one last quick question. We're running out of time. But since you're coming to New Zealand, there is one question that New Zealand audiences always want asked of any band or any act that comes here. What are you planning to do while you're in New Zealand?
Well, you guys are the most active people on Earth, you know. You jump off of everything and ride your boats faster than anybody. You're crazy.
So what will you be jumping off?
I kind of gave up the jumping off of things a few years ago.
Very wise.
Because I get up in front of thousands of people every night, and I have all the adrenaline I need.
That's fair.
So I will be taking those lovely walks in your gorgeous, gorgeous cities and towns and wherever I am, and I will be eating some of your finest cuisine and food that you have, because we always search for that. There's sort of farm-to-table stuff, and your local... We like to support the female chefs everywhere we go, and we try to find the restaurants. So that's what we'll be doing.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. Well, you're coming to Auckland next month. I think we're seeing you in Auckland, and then I believe you're doing Hamilton and Wellington. So it's quite a fantastic little lineup you're doing.
Yeah.
You're going to be in Auckland on the 9th of April, and we're looking forward to seeing you. So, Melissa Etheridge, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to Crave this morning.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, I look forward to seeing you. Bye-bye now.
All right, bye-bye.
So that's Melissa Etheridge, who's going to be touring with Sheryl Crow in the North Island, not the South, next month. Definitely worth going to. And stay tuned, because in the next few weeks, Crave will have free tickets to give away for those shows.
Ooh, good. I hope we get to go as well.
Well, it depends. We'll see. Yeah, you might have to enter, Simon. Now,
okay.
Before that, a last word. We'll give it to you.
Yes.
Now, you had two words before for Death Wish.
Yes,
and neither of them were Bruce Willis.
No, my words are don't go. I'll add please.
oh, dear.
Well, and the reason is, it's not that this is a clumsy film about a vigilante. It's actually the opposite, because... You've actually got some good actors here. There's Elizabeth Shue, Vincent D'Onofrio. You've got a carefully thought out film. It's got a slow and intricate, build up. It doesn't rush into things. And you could argue it's quite a well-crafted film. And because of that, it makes it, I suppose, a more effective piece of propaganda.
Ooh.
And I think it is propaganda.
Explain that one, please.
Well, I just think I thought the more I thought about it, the more insidious it seems to me, because it's telling a story about Bruce Willis playing this vigilante. He's a doctor, and I'm not going to go on about this. Let me just summarize what I think the message, in blunt English, what the message is here about if you're a vigilante. This film is saying it's okay to kill someone who's committed an atrocity against your family. This film is saying, if you do this, you'll actually feel better for it. This film is saying, it's also okay to kill a few other criminals unrelated to what happened to your family, but if you happen to stumble across them, go ahead and execute them. And this film is also saying, if the police happen to figure out that you are the killer, they won't mind. They'll turn a blind eye, and they'll let you get away with it.
Oh, dear.
No, no. And no.
Tell me, and this is going to be a very difficult question, I accept, but I'm going to throw it at you anyway.
Yeah.
Is it possible to separate out your moral and philosophical and ethical contempt for this film from any possible artistic merit?
The problem, I couldn't. I couldn't myself. And the... I'd like to think of myself that I would take that view at any time, but at the in current in the current events of the day, in days and months and years in which we are now living, in which in America the issue of gun control and who can use a gun and when and where, and when we've got an American president saying let's arm the teachers so they can dissuade gun-toting students, I found it impossible really to divorce the affairs of the day from what this, the message of this film. And I don't, probably we weren't meant to. There are some good, I mean, there are some, there's a, as I say, some decent actors, some decent scenes, some thrilling scenes, I suppose you could say. But I really did feel increasingly uncomfortable with it. I don't think I saw the original Charles Bronson movie when it came out back in 74. I was probably wouldn't have got into the cinema back then, but and I think I read that it was also controversial in its day. I just think people actually will probably just dismiss this. I don't think it's caused a huge stir because I think most people won't bother seeing it, and I've seen it, so you don't have to. So
that to be fair could be Crave's motto, couldn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Seeing films so you don't have to see them.
That's right. So let's leave it at that. It is a vigilante film, and I think it's propaganda. And now that I've got that off my chest, Mr. McCabe, just to get my mind off that, is there anything else coming up in the music or film department that perhaps can take my mind off things?
I think we need to have a bit of a palate cleanse here, don't we?
Yes, we do.
We do. In films, we got the new, I think it's Steven Spielberg film, isn't it?
Ready Player One. Yeah.
Ready Player One's going to be previewed next week. That's coming soon. I've always had a fascination for things biblical, so I want to go and see Mary Magdalene next week. I do wonder if that's going to be any good, but I'll give it a look anyway.
Yes.
And then on the musical front, the most curiously named band of the year, Portugal the Man.
Portugal the Man.
Portugal full stop the Man, if you don't mind.
What a name, my word.
But they're also an awful lot of good fun. They're actually a really entertaining band. I've listened to their records a little bit, and they're going to be at the Power Station on Tuesday the 8th of May, and I think that's going to be worth a look.
Okay.
It's going to be, you know, they're not a band whose name you chant before they come on stage, to be fair.
Yes, that's right.
But they're going to be fun. One that I know you're going to be very keen to see.
Oh, don't tell me. Go on, yes.
No, well, no, don't sound so disappointed.
I think you're not going to tell me that Celine Dion's doing the third show.
She is.
Oh!
But you've ruined the big reveal for later on now, Mercep. No, fine. In that case, I'm not going to tell you that Tash Sultana's coming to Auckland Town Hall.
Ah, yes. Well, now you're talking. Now you're talking.
Yeah, but not to you, though, because you just ruined my big reveal. July the 24th.
Right, well, I will be there because she's fantastic.
You were most impressed, weren't you?
I was. She was at the Auckland City Limits Festival just a couple of weekends ago. A really talented musician and performer. I thoroughly, thoroughly recommend you see her if you get the chance.
Right. Celine Dion, third Auckland show. We'll dismiss that one out of fan because, yeah, you've ruined that for me now. I'm guessing also means you're probably not going to be terribly impressed that Michael Bolton's coming to town.
Michael, who, sorry?
Michael Bolton.
Oh, right.
You don't know the name?
I do know the name. I do know the name. I think we're talking middle of the road sort of crooner, are we, sort of?
The very fella. And he's going to be doing... they're calling it the Michael Bolton Symphony Tour because he's going to have the Auckland Philharmonic Orchestra backing him. He's going to do a greatest hit show, that, you know, his own songs, stuff he's written for other folk. And he's written for all kinds of people. You don't realise, you know, he's written for Barbara Streisand. He's written for Cher. He's written for Kenny G, for that matter. Laura Branigan. Mm-hmm. Apparently he's written for Kiss, but I find that very hard to believe. And he's going to be at the Civic in Auckland on June the 19th with, as I say, the Auckland Symphony.
Well, actually, probably an artist like that with an orchestra would probably be a pretty nice night out, I suspect.
You know he's going to ooze class. You know that much.
Yeah, yeah. Yep,
another one that's going to be really, really cool.
Mm.
I don't know if you... No, seriously. I don't know if you're familiar with a man called Public Service Broadcasting.
I used to work in public service broadcasting.
Not this version of it, you didn't, mate.
Okay.
They're a strange band. Well, let's see what I can tell you from the press release. It says that spellbinding live audio and visual transmissions weave samples from vintage public information films, archive footage and propaganda material around live drums, guitars, banjo, synths and electronics. So what they do is, each of their albums, the last one I listened to was one called The Race for Space. They take a historic theme.
Yep.
And it's a concept album. And every song has lyrics and then audio clips that come from that bit of history.
Yep.
The music's the like, for example, when they're talking about, you know, successful space shipping, it's all big stirring, rousing chords. And when it's you know, disasters in space, it's really dramatic, really tense music. And they do a full, basically, sort of audio visual multimedia immersive experience on stage. So I'm actually quite excited by that one.
Yeah, I think that would be, I think I, now that you mention it, I have heard of them, and I think I've even seen a video clip of them, and it looked pretty damn interesting. Yeah.
Well, that's so that going to be Thursday the 3rd of May, and again, the Power Station in Auckland is the place to be for that one.
Okay.
So there's some really good stuff, and there's also some very good comedy coming up that I'm really excited about.
Okay. The comedy festival, of course.
Yes, but this is a solo guy.
Okay.
Are you familiar with the name Andy Zaltzman?
Oh, I don't think so.
You might know his ex-podcast partner.
Okay.
John Oliver.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Okay.
The two of them used to do a podcast together called The Bugle.
Okay,
which was very, very bitingly satirical. If you've seen Oliver's stuff on TV,
yes,
imagine
yes.
that with the gloves off.
Okay.
And fewer New Zealand references.
Okay, yeah. He would be worth seeing.
And that's what Andy Zaltzman does. Now, we're hoping to have an interview with him on Crave in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, he's going to be doing one night in Wellington on Monday, April the 30th at the Te Awaha Theatre in Wellington. Then he's got two nights, Tuesday the 1st and Wednesday the 2nd of May at the Q Theatre here in Auckland. And I think that's going to be, I've heard him on the radio, frankly, trouser-wettingly funny.
Oh, one. In this day and age, we need that sort of thing every now and then.
He is very, very good.
Okay, fantastic. Great stuff. All right, lots to look forward to. Okay, well, look, that's our podcast. That's Crave. Thank you very much for listening to Steve and I chomp our way through a number of items of popular culture.
Thank you to listening to us venting our bitter disappointments.
Yes. As always, very pleased to hear what you've got to say about the material we cover. So, look, if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us on podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter @cravepodcast.com. So if you want to tell Simon why he's wrong about Death Wish, we'd love to hear it.
Oh, yes. And I will faithfully report back in the next podcast what you've got to say. In the meantime, thanks again. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.